Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. It's the 6th of July, 2026. It's half past eight on a very sunny day. How lovely is that? Another sunny day. We could do with some water up on the land, but we seem to be in this engineered sunshine. Mind you, I'm not complaining. We are managing to get everything watered anyway. So that's all good. I'm making myself a cup of... was going to have a cup of coffee, only I need to go to the farm shop and get some milk. So I've run out. So instead... where's my cup? Here it is. Here it is. I'm going to have a fruit tea. I think I've got these apple teas, which are very lovely and very refreshing. This morning, I have... my mobile mechanic coming over to have a look at my van because where's the kettle? It's gone into limp mode. It was serviced about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and the little engine light didn't go off. I mean, it seemed perfectly fine, but I've had this issue with the exhaust, and apparently. You're supposed to just drive, and then it clears the exhaust filter, I think it is. And it's been, you know, moaning at me, and it says, drive to clear. So I've been driving. And to be honest with you, it hasn't cleared. And then all of a sudden, I've got these flashing notices up saying, service now. So I got in touch with my mobile mechanic, and he said, oh, I'm off, I'm away for a week. So I said, oh, well, when can you do it? And he said... told me, you know, today, and I said, oh, well, it's got this, and it's gone into limp mode. He said, no, it's all right, you should be able to drive it all right, but just take it easy. So anyway, he's coming today, and hopefully whatever it is can be sorted out. So it's just a pain, isn't it, like all these things. You rely on the van. Well, I rely on the van. You don't. You probably rely on your own vehicular mode of transport, whatever that is. I'm also going to have a piece of bread, toast rather. I thought this morning, and I hope you don't mind, I'm going to do that as we natter. Coming to the end of this loaf. But I can get two slices out of it. So let's just shove those in the toaster. It's quite a thick slice, that one. And let me pour my drink out. Allow me to. Yes, there's not really much you can do to stop me because I've already done it now. There it is. Take a moment or two to cool down after it's had its infusion. Ah, there we go. Lovely. Nice apple. The other day, whenever it was, we dug up some of the potatoes just to see. Yesterday we were down at Julia's mum's and dad's for a Sunday roast, go and visit her and make sure they're all okay, which was good. And we took the potatoes down with us. Actually, the idea was that she was going to cook them, but she'd actually cook some other potatoes, so we didn't get those. But we've got some extras, of course, so we'll probably have them this evening. Which would be nice. It's nice to be able to have now the produce actually coming. I mean, it is a huge outlay for year one to, you know, get some produce, broad beans, cabbage, kale and what have you. Cucumbers are doing really well. They've grown. Oh, you know, we bought two pots. They were £1 each and they were scrawny looking things. And now... you know, I don't know what they are, about 6 foot high, quite incredible, with the little, they look like little mini cucumbers at the moment, but they are growing. So that's nice. So yes, it's really exciting. Of course, as I say, it's this huge investment year one, but it will, of course, come down. And it's healthy food, grown on ourselves. We know what we put on them or not put on them. As the case may be. So it's going to get my a plate and some butter ready for my toast. So that's all good, and we're still thoroughly enjoying it. We are, this must be now the 11th month. We were allowed to go in early because the guy selling the land, once it was in the process of selling, he was off to Shropshire. So he said, look, you know, you're buying it, aren't you? You're not going to pull out. You may as well just get cracking. He knew, of course, that there was a hell of a lot of clearance stuff. And it doesn't matter how much clearance you do. The tendency for nature is to keep growing. So there's a lot of just pure maintenance, maintaining what one has already done. But it's a lot easier than the initial clearing, of course. I have put on my chainsaw chain, my other chain. I bought this file. I can't remember if I mentioned this. I bought this file, and I think I buggered up the chainsaw. So I had to go and buy another chainsaw chain. I'm just getting my toast out. Come on. There you come. So, fair bit of carbon on that one. Anyway, so now it cuts really well. And there was a couple of logs I needed to do. In fact, I was talking about them in the last Naked Englishman, not the, the English couple. And I've sawn them up, and now I've just got to get the tractor in to, when I'm next up there, to pull out these logs. Well, these are fallen trees that fell into an area of brambles that we hadn't yet got round to clearing. We've been very busy with other areas. You'd think, you know, 2.5 acres. If you looked at it, if you stood on a field that was just grass, look at 2.5 acres, you think, well, it's not very big. But because this has got brambles, thistles and trees, willows, oaks and hazels and a few fruit trees, you know, it's got these little areas, and it makes it appear far bigger than it really is. And then, of course, there's all the Christmas trees that are there. So the area does look larger, and it's got more nooks and crannies, which we actually like. And so it's very nice. You know, some people have bought a flat piece of land with nothing on it, and then had to plant everything. We've been graced by having a number of things. The Christmas trees, which are 60 foot tall or whatever the height they are they're a blessing and a curse in some ways. They're a blessing because they are a good windbreak and they're free wood to build our polytunnels and things. They're a curse because they've got to come down, and I'm not experienced with some of the taller ones on actually bringing them down. So that might be expensive, as I have to get probably somebody in who might well be able to teach me how to do it, or at least do it, and I can, you know, film some of it and give it a go. But a bit nervous about all of that, as you can probably imagine, when it's something outside your remit. But I brought down some of the smaller ones, same sort of height, but they're thinner. They're just narrower trees. So that's okay. Now, you're going to have to excuse me. I am going to have a munch. I'm quite hungry and thirsty. I should have done this before, but I'm recording it now. And let me just put the microphone up here so you can get the full benefit of the eating sound. Now, I know some people don't like it, so you may have to turn off if you are queasy about people eating. But people eat, don't you? It's a natural thing. Now, try not to talk too much with my mouth full, if I can help it. I think I read to you... Did I read to you some excerpts from some books we purchased recently? The Tess of the D'Urbervilles, I think I read. I can't remember now. Nice arrange, nice books. I finished one by J.B. Priestley recently called It's an Old Country. Interesting book, interesting idea. an Australian is in search of his father in England. I believe his mother was English. They go to... the father and mother split up. The hero, the son, doesn't know why. On her deathbed, she says, "Please find your father." And there's a sort of mystery about who he was and what he had been doing. Anyway, odd book. And although I like J.B. Priestley, some of the prose and some of the dialogue seemed unrealistic. They got into subjects without easing into them. So much so that it seemed rather theatrical. Now, I know that J.B. Priestley likes writing about theatrical types. He wrote Lost Empires, which was about old variety theatre, and The Good Companions, which again was a similar sort of travelling troupe of theatre performers. And reading with Julia, we're reading it aloud, one called Bright Ideas by J.B. Priestley. And that's about a guy remembering his childhood, but he's a screenwriter. And that's really nice and interesting, because there's two parallel stories going on, which, funny enough, my story about the 1940s is a similar thing. It's a woman remembering what it was like on a farm during the Battle of Britain and the adventures she had, and then contrasting that with the world today, and how things have changed and people's sensibilities have changed, I suppose, and whether one was better or what was, you know, what bits have we thrown away which we ought to have kept. Anyway, going back to the It's an Old Country, it was good in places, and then all of a sudden the ending, it was almost as if he suddenly realised that he'd been writing for several hundred, however many, you know, thousand words it is, and thought, oh crikey, I've got to tie this up. And then suddenly he'd been going around looking for his father, and then in the last 10, 20 pages, he finds his father in a most boring way. If you haven't read it, I won't tell you. And it was the first unsatisfying book that I've read for a long time. So, there you go. But ordinarily, I like his work. He has an interesting style. Having put that one down, I'm now reading another R.F. Delderfield. I think it's called Come Home, Charlie, and Face Them. Then he just started. To me, R.F. Delderfield is a master writer. His turn of phrase and the way he puts things over a second to none. I know there's wonderful writers like Laurie Lee, Suddenly I Walked Out One Morning, or whatever it is, which is poetry in prose, and it's beautifully written. And you have to read that very slowly, because every word is, you know, important and counts and all those things. And you sort of lose yourself in a different way. And if you're a writer, you're also somewhat conscious of the incredible turn of phrases that he uses and his descriptive power of observation. Well, I wouldn't say R.F. Delderfield was on that. Very similar but different. He writes about people in just such a classy way. And sometimes they just laugh out loud bits of prose. I did read To Serve Them All Their Days, which is a famous one of his. I think that was the very first one I read. And it's a saga, and it goes on. It was a little unsatisfying, because it just went on and on. I thought, you've come to the end, surely. You don't need to keep going. We read, Julia and I, fairly recently, a Winston Graham novel. And that was a peculiar one. It was very good until the end. And the end came about 50 pages before he'd finished writing. And then there was... It wasn't, I don't think, written as an epilogue, but there was... You know, it was sort of built up to a crescendo. We had the crescendo. The hero survived. And it kind of fizzled to the end of where you would normally expect the end. And you did feel that the publisher said, oh, we need another 50 pages. And so then there was this piffle, really, about what happened afterwards. And it wasn't interesting, and it didn't take the story anywhere. And I thought, well, that's a bit of a shame, because I like Winston Graham overall. He wrote the Pole Dark stories, of course. But he wrote numerous other things. And it's interesting... Sorry about the eating. It is interesting how certain writers, I suppose, to make a living and to continue to sell books and satisfy their publishers, they invent a character... say, Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, or Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot, and to a degree, Miss Marple, that they get lumbered with. And I say that because I believe that both Agatha Christie and Conan Doyle, having written about them, sort of thought, well, that was it, really. I've done it. But the readers... said, we want more. We want more adventures of these characters. The publishers obviously made it lucrative for them to continue. And rather than writing other stuff that they wanted to write, they were forced to do the stuff that the audience wants. And I can see that because you get the same with actors, don't you? For example, Kenneth Williams, who... was extremely funny, got fed up with doing the Carry On films and stuff, you know, and he wanted to do more serious acting. But it wasn't suited to it, in as much as, not saying he couldn't do it, I'm sure he could do it very well, but the audience wouldn't let him. They weren't interested in some serious Shakespearean acting from Kenneth Williams. They wanted the old, oh no, he's something mucking about. Excuse me. And same with Norman Wisdom. Once he'd invented his Gump character, that sort of made him famous. But he wanted to do some more serious acting, and people wouldn't take him seriously. Towards the end of his life, he did a couple of roles, I think, which were more serious. But it wasn't what people went to go and see in... a Norman Wisdom film. And but some people, like, say, Clint Eastwood, of course, was quite happy doing these very powerful characters, mavericks. And because they were mavericks, and there was a certain sort of Clint Eastwood squint and stare and silence and, you know, doing all of that, he and being, you know, not so much the little man, but a man being tormented by others, that
He could do it in as Dirty Harry as a police detective or as a cowboy. And yet, you know, you could argue that very similar, they're all the same character. Now, I don't know if he wanted to do any more than that. But seeing as he was obviously being paid millions of pounds, as opposed to thousands of pounds that Norman Wisdom and Kenneth Williams would have had, and he directed films, perhaps there was a lot more satisfaction. Anyway, I'm sure Winston Graham probably was writing Poldark and thought, I've told this story, I'm fed up with it now, and it keeps going on. But I get the impression that R.F. Delderfield, on the other hand, absolutely thrived on the stories he wrote, particularly the sagas. He wrote 6 hours a day. I mean, it's very impressive, every day. But then when you think of other people like Anthony Trollope, and he was writing in the Victorian era, of course, and had a tremendous output. And presumably he was writing it all by hand, and then it all had to be typeset. And, you know, his books are extremely long. And I tried to read one of them, which were interesting observations. You know, I think sometimes you have to go back, don't you, to a book because you're not ready for it. And that might be you're not intellectually ready for it or you're not patiently ready for it. Sometimes it's very easy to be impatient on a story. And it depends how you've come to it, I think. If you've come to it from other similar books, you're in the mode. If you've come to it from I don't know, high adventure or preposterous adventure, sort of like James Bond type books, secret agents, and then you go to a much slower, more fastidious type of book, in which, of course, the writer is writing a lot of descriptive text, mainly because a lot of people would not have known things, unlike today, where in the last 50 years we've had television and feature films, and people have been exposed to things that you wouldn't have to go into much detail to describe because we would know about it thanks to the ever-present television type thing. And now, of course, with the internet and what have you, we're very familiar with a lot of things. Back then, in very simple lives, things that went on in one part of the country, dialect, different professions may not even have been known by people in a different part of the country. So you would have to describe in greater detail things so that you're conjuring up the images in people's head. Now you can say, I don't know, off the top of my head, what a train station is like, a mainline city train station with its Victoriana. Well, we can immediately picture that. But if you lived in a rural Devonshire village all your life and didn't do a lot of travelling and you only went to the market in Pony and Trap type thing, but you were interested in reading, it would seem quite exotic to hear about a Victorian, the architecture being described to you of a terminus train station like King's Cross or even down on the south coast, Brighton. With all of that finery and what people were dressed in. And so you would spend a lot more time describing that. And so now when you go back and you read these classics, you might think, oh, it's taking forever to get the story on because there's so much descriptive work. But of course, from our point of view, looking back, it's fascinating also to understand the intricacies of what people wore or how they spoke or walked or their business operations. I always find that interesting. So that sometimes is a good thing from our perspective because times have moved on. And the other thing I always think is interesting when you read, say, a period piece of the 1950s, 60s, that sort of 1940s, that sort of thing. And again, people are talking about what they wore in their work and the minutiae of everyday living. Because we live so differently and so much is done for us, and everything is convenient. You just nip down and, you know, get your convenience foods, whatever it might be. And then you read about, say, you know, the dairyman filling up his urns, getting them onto the back of the cart and the horse and going on his round, and knowing that that milk that he's delivering is not cooled. And as the morning is going, and people, you know, women would come out with jugs and fill up a jug, and you'd think, gosh, you know, we would put them straight into the fridge. But back then, say at the turn in the 20s or what have you, they may not have fridges, or in rural villages where they don't have electricity. So they would have larders and cold rooms or cold areas. And some of the big houses would have had ice houses and things. And it's lovely to read that detail retrospectively. And the great thing about it is that you know that it must have been so, and it's not an exaggeration, for a lot of those books were read for people of the same time. And so it's not an author exaggerating, because people reading it would go, well, that's not what happens. It's like us talking about, in this day and age, talking about, I don't know, parcel delivery, and how some companies will just leave them on the doorstep, not even knock on the door. And if somebody wrote that in a book and it wasn't what happens, we're going, well, that's preposterous. But because we know that does happen, and we know that the drivers are so busy that sometimes they can't find your house, so they don't bother to stay more than a couple of seconds and then drive off, and it's on the vehicle for the next day. And meanwhile, you've spotted the vehicle and you're just about to go out, as happened to me, and say, oh, I'm here. And they've driven off because they're so pressured to make these deliveries that they can't spend a couple of minutes actually walking up and down the road going, where is this house? I've got to deliver it. Now, if you wrote that in a book today, we would understand and accept it and go, yeah, that's bloody typical. But in the future, in, say, 50 years' time, somebody reading that, that sort of level of detail is interesting, because no doubt everything is dropped off by drones or, you know, some other means. Or maybe there are no such things as these deliveries anymore. Perhaps everything is printed by 3D printing. You just order it and it comes in. Who knows what the future is going to look like? It sounds quite hideous, really. And so retrospectively, looking back at the current time, it's interesting to see what we do. And I think that's where fictional writing works really well, because you're talking about people, especially if you're writing it for that time. Because you're writing about people, and you know it must be so, because people would have said, well, that's a bit over the top, isn't it? Delivery drivers don't just leave them at the door. They're ever so polite, and they wear, you know, if we said that they wear a special uniform that was heavy wool, and I'm thinking like a Victorian station master, you know, very, very smart, shiny boots, took great pride in their appearance and saluted as you opened the door and said, good morning, madam, I have a very nice parcel from Newcastle for you. You know, if you wrote that in a book and said that was what's happened today, you wouldn't believe it. Now people would go, well, that's not true. That's what I mean about it must be so when a book is written, say, in the 40s for the audience of the day. Now we look back and go, oh, that's fascinating. I think I've laboured that point beyond all possible recognition. Anyway, I think that's probably me done for the day, and I must get on and do some stuff. And thank you for bearing with me. Until next time, take care. Goodbye.